today on Against the Grain. How should we understand the relationship between capitalists, big and small, and the Republican and Democratic parties, especially in the wake of Trump's return to power? Stephen Marr discusses the sectors of capital that support and oppose him. He traces the rise of the MAGA right to forces set in motion by the global economic crisis, and he discusses under what circumstances big business, much of which is currently wary of Trump, might throw its support behind authoritarian rule. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Trump's politics, both as president and again now, are often contradictory, which detractors frequently attribute to his erratic character. But my guest Stephen Marr argues that they're a product of the sectors of society and the business classes that back him and which are frequently at odds. Rather than trying to make sense of Trump as a mercurial personality, Marr says we should examine the class forces and crisis of political legitimacy that have produced him, as well as the dominant sectors of the capitalist class that have backed the Democrats. Stephen Marr teaches economics at SUNY Cortland. He's the author, with Scott Aquino, of The Fall and Rise of American Finance, which is published by Verso. He's also the co-editor of The Socialist Register. Steve, before we talk about the relationship between the capitalist class and the Republicans and Democrats, could you set the stage for us by describing the state of U.S. capitalism, both economically and politically, following the Great Recession of 2008?
The 2008 crisis kind of marked a turning point in the history of American capitalism. It really was, you know, one of the most profound and deep crises in the history of American capitalism. And it was certainly the deepest crisis since the 1930s. In our recent book with Scott Aquino, The Fall and Rise of American Finance, which I talked with you about recently, we basically argue that it's one of three great crises in the history of American capitalism, one being the Great Depression of the 1930s, one being the 1970s crisis, and then the third being the 2008 crisis. And it really did lead to, as a result of the efforts by the state, and particularly the Federal Reserve, to reconstruct the collapsing financial system, it really did lead to a kind of new phase in American capitalism, characterized by the overwhelming dominance of a new group of asset management companies, which, you know, are different from traditional banks, in that they don't engage in, you know, the usual lending, they're not organized around the usual banking practices, but primarily own assets, own stock. And they now are the largest owners, basically, of every single publicly traded American corporation, with an average of 20% holdings in each firm. So they really have overwhelming power within American capitalism. And this has seen a shift from the traditional, you know, from an American capitalist system dominated by the traditional banks, to a capitalist system dominated by these new, well, they're not new, but their position is new, financial institutions, what might be called the shadow banking sector, in that it's relatively outside of the scope of the traditional methods of state regulation. But yeah, it's a new phase in American capitalism, characterized by unprecedented concentration and centralization of ownership of corporations.
And so that is how things were reshaped from above. Can you talk about the way the Great Recession upended and accelerated a crisis of legitimacy that predates it, but in terms of how the state and the parties in power, the capitalist class, are able to govern, how would you say that shifted out of that crisis?
So yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the way capitalism works is that the state is as we say in Marxist, in the tradition of Marxist state theory, the state is relatively autonomous from capital, meaning that it has to have some distance from the dominant centers of economic power. It's not just the instrument of the most powerful corporations. It actually is somewhat independent from them. And that independence is a condition for the state to be able to organize the general long-term interests of the system as a whole. And it does so by organizing what the theorist Nikos Poulantzas called a unstable equilibrium of compromise among competing capitalist fractions. So the state has to organize this consensus among the capitalist class to pull together a political, you know, a structure of political hegemony, a structure of political power among a fragmented class that is competing with each other, right? So the capitalist class can't rule directly. It needs the state to organize the overall class interests of the capitalist class, because individual capitalists are just kind of concerned with their own bottom lines. And so that means that the state has to be able to pull together this alliance in order to be able to have a functional political order. And since 2008, well, one of the consequences of 2008 is that while you saw in the years following 2008, certainly an economic recovery in the case of the American economy, politically speaking, there has the way that that crisis was resolved economically led to a political, you know, deepening political contradictions and ultimately a political crisis. Because even though overall you see profitability restored, you see growth relatively restored, you see productivity now coming back, the small capital and the kind of sole proprietor petty bourgeois types, they got absolutely hammered by the 2008 crisis. And the way that that crisis was resolved didn't appear to take account of their interests. And in fact, the construction sector, for example, that was such a major part of the way that these fractions of capital and the petty bourgeoisie, you might call them, were surviving, suffered a prolonged difficulties, and that made it difficult for these people to get access to financing. It made it difficult for them to be able to return to the life that they had been living during the boom years of the construction boom prior to the 2008 crisis. And that led to the radicalization of these parts of the capitalist class and the petty bourgeoisie, which motivated and underpinned the, you know, rise of the Tea Party movement and ultimately culminated in MAGA politics. So what you see is a deepening kind of crisis within what we might call the power block, the ruling alliance, these kind of parts of you know, the capitalist class and the petty bourgeoisie that have tended to be integrated within the ruling alliance. And so you see the deepening contradictions between these different components of the ruling alliance. And you also have this kind of festering discontent with political and economic institutions in the U.S., a widespread discrediting and lack of confidence in the problem-solving and capacities of the state and in the state's legitimacy. And this is related to, you know, rising cost of living. This is acutely, I think, in the last election, felt in terms of rising cost of living due to inflation. I think it's due to the fact that you see, you know, segments of the kind of professional class, the middle class, that is experiencing downward mobility. And so there's a sense that the state and the capitalist system in its current form is unable to provide people with the standard of living and the future that they might feel entitled to. And this has led to, you know, the widespread delegitimation of the state and of the economic institutions that dominate our society. And these anti-establishment sentiments have been complemented by, you know, have led to the erosion of the traditional political parties. So the Republican and Democratic establishments were both widely discredited and generally despised. And that created space after 2008 for both Trump and Sanders insurgencies to kind of gain power, gain steam within those party institutions in a way that led to them becoming dysfunctional from the point of view of the powers that be, as it were, the dominant sectors of capital, right? Those parties, their normal role would be to represent in a relatively straightforward and unproblematic fashion the interests of big capital, if you like. And what the Trump insurgency and the Sanders insurgency did was create contradictions that complicated that normal process of political rule through those parties. And so you have this widespread delegitimation of the state and the dominant economic institutions. You have this growing anti-establishment sentiment. you have the erosion and the dysfunction of the political system, right? The political system is not working from the point of view of capital. And then you have the emergence of these new political projects, right? Which are anti-establishment political projects, one of which is coming from the far right, led by a frustrated and radicalized petty bourgeoisie, with alongside, of course, elements of the working class and the lumpen proletariat. And on the other side, you have a left-wing insurgency led by Bernie Sanders, which was, you know, comprised of downwardly mobile and radicalized sections of the managerial class and the kind of college-educated middle class, and as well as sections of the working class. And from the point of view of capital, neither one of these things was particularly desirable. Although, of course, given the choice, we know which one they would choose. It would not be Sanders. It would be Trump. But neither of these projects were compatible with the, were consistent with the normal forms of rule within the American state that we've seen certainly throughout the post-1970s period, but also probably since the New Deal.
And I want to go back and talk to you much more about those divisions that you're flagging, but you brought us to the recent elections. And of course, there's been a tsunami of punditry and analysis of what went wrong or why did Trump win. And I wanted to ask you, because what you're laying out for us by following the sort of long trajectory of the things set in motion or intensified by the Great Recession, as you say, starting with the Tea Party and going beyond, when you describe those, you're talking about kind of a consolidation of the far right on the one hand, but also the pull of a lot of voters who might have voted for, say, Obama in previous elections who voted for Trump. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think that the argument that white supremacy or patriarchy are not sufficient enough explanations for why voters went for Trump in this election?
I think, as often happens in historical situations in which economic inequality has become so overwhelming and in which large parts of the, broad swaths of the population find the situation intolerable and therefore unsustainable, what you basically had in the election was a contest between a party, the Democrats, which was running on the message that everything's great, the economy is wonderful, and if you don't agree, you must be an uneducated deplorable, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, a Republican Party that was saying everything's messed up, everything's terrible. We need fundamental radical change because there's the liberal establishment is delusional and totally out of touch with what's going on with common people. And so you have this situation in which broad swaths of the population find the situation intolerable and therefore politically, and therefore the situation is politically unsustainable. And yet a Democratic Party that's running on its attachment and representation of an unsustainable status quo. So the Democrats, you know, their position was simply not viable. They're running on continuing an unsustainable situation, whereas the Republicans were running on fundamentally altering that situation. And so I think, you know, just at the level of affect, which I'm convinced played a large role in driving this electoral outcome, you have one side that's really angry and wants to change everything and feels frustrated and unheard and is expressing those sentiments. And then the other side that is kind of in this relatively smug, haughty fashion, claiming that the economy is going great. Just look at the data. And if you don't agree, you must be misled by propaganda and conspiracy theories and all the rest of it. And so it's no, you know, and meanwhile, of course, that same party is carrying out a genocide and touting how its program, Kamala Harris, literally went around touting how her economic program was favored by Goldman Sachs. So given the electoral choice between Goldman Sachs and genocide or, you know, fundamental change and frustration and anger at the status quo, which is untenable from the point of view of broad swaths of the population, you know, 10 million Democratic voters stayed home. And you know, many people voted for the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, which isn't that surprising to me, to be honest. Of course, you know, the decline of patriarchy played a role in this. I mean, I think that there is a nostalgic yearning among some white men and perhaps non-white men for bygone days, you know, mythic bygone days when a man was a man and there was a single, or, you know, sole breadwinner household. and you know, patriarchy was, you know, part of the core fabric of American life. And I think the nostalgia for those for that bygone era, you know, mixes with or is an expression of, in part, frustration with the present. And so what you see, I think, is a situation in which, you know, the political crisis that we're now in creates an opportunity for reactionary forces to put forward an alternative to an unsustainable status quo that is a return to white dominated, patriarchal, et cetera, which has indeed declined in the recent period in the context of the ascent of liberal multiculturalism and all the rest of it. And I think that message was able to find a receptive audience in, precisely because of the unsustainable social situation and the lack of a real left alternative that could chart a way out of this situation on the basis of egalitarian and inclusive principles.
I'm speaking with Stephen Marr. He's co-editor of The Socialist Register and co-author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, backing up to make sense of the alliances of the present, I wonder if you could tell us about the relationship between the Republicans, the Republican Party, and the capitalist class, the business class, as well as small business owners, the petty bourgeoisie that you mentioned, which has historically, you know, since the New Deal, been the bulwark of the far right, the supporters of the John Birch Society and so on. How would you characterize the Republican Party traditionally before the Trump era?
The Republican Party has historically had this role in American politics of what you might call recuperating sections of the population that might otherwise be left out of the alliance in power, especially small business and the petty bourgeoisie. And the way it's done that is, well I guess the contradictions between small business and the petty bourgeoisie and big capital, they run deep, right? They have to do with the contradictions of the American state's imperial project of making global capitalism, right? Constructing a world tied together by the free mobility of investment, right? The ability of capitalists to invest anywhere on planet Earth basically cost-free, wherever labor costs and regulatory costs are the lowest. And one of the contradictions, of course, of that project has been so-called deindustrialization, where, you know, industrial jobs have been relocated geographically to zones where labor costs and regulatory costs are lower, thereby leaving behind, you know, American workers in the so-called Rust Belt, right? What used to be the productive heartland, the industrial heartland of American society, is now known as the Rust Belt, precisely because it's full of rusting out, you know, factories that used to be producing things. And so that means that not only have workers been defeated, but also, so workers have been defeated in the sense that their jobs have been sent abroad, but also small business owners and petty bourgeois types have faced increasing competition. You know, these firms that can't globalize their operations, that can't internationalize their production chains, they have been faced with a deluge of cheaper imports in many cases, which has squeezed them and made it very hard to keep them on board with the overall project of liberalization. That's created an ongoing conflict in terms of within the American, you know, the ruling alliance between these small business types and the petty bourgeoisie on the one hand, and big capital, financial and industrial capital that has been very tied in with, you know, liberalization and globalization on the other hand. And the way that these forces, these groupings that have been kind of left behind the liberalization project, you know, the project of globalization, have been recuperated into the alliance in power has been through the Republican Party's role of swinging to the far right and organizing and politically representing those sections of the population, both, you know, including small business and the petty bourgeoisie, as well as the expanding lumpen proletariat and precarious, increasingly precarious working class, members of the working class, and representing those sections of society within the political system. And its ability to do that has hinged on the ability of the Democratic Party to continuously play this role as the quote-unquote responsible manager of capitalism. So you see this especially in the Goldwater years, right, where the Republican Party swung to the hard right. It brought into the political system in a very contradictory and problematic way these left behind sections of society. But the Democratic Party, again and again and again, comes in and saves the day by serving as the responsible manager of capitalism, and the hegemony of big capital within the Democratic Party has basically been secured more or less since the 1970s. Although, of course, the Democratic Party is also representative of a coalition of classes and fractions of classes, and the conflicts between those groups can't be predicted or can oftentimes create their own contradictions and issues. But by and large, the Democratic Party has been able to step in as the responsible manager of capitalism to sustain, quote unquote, normal forms of political rule. So prior to the Trump years, there was already a kind of ongoing conflict between, the petty bourgeoisie and small capital and the sections of big capital that have been most directly tied in with the project of globalization and liberalization. And the interests of the latter, the big capital, the financial and industrial firms, the big financial and industrial firms, has been represented and protected through being institutionalized within parts of the state apparatus that are not subject to, electoral change. So you have, the power of the central bank has been, rendered quote unquote independent, right? The whole idea of central bank independence is supposed to be that no matter who wins the election, it does the same thing. And the interests that it represents in doing that same thing are the interests of the largest and most powerful sections of capital, which are multinational in nature. And so the interests of those groupings have been protected and thoroughly ensconced within these parts of the state apparatus that are beyond electoral and quote unquote political intervention. Whereas the weaker parts of capital, right, the petty bourgeoisie and small capital, have been relegated to lobbying Congress in order to have their interests heard, right, and participating in mobilizing behind hard right candidates, or in some cases Democratic candidates, which is the way that they've had their interests expressed within the political system. So what's interesting is that increasingly lobbying Congress became a sign of the weakness of a particular fraction of capital rather than the strength, right? Because the stronger parts of capital, the bigger and more powerful parts of capital, had their interests protected and institutionalized within parts of the state that are venues wherein those interests can be expressed and represented without the interference and meddling of these other parts of society. Which isn't to say that big capital doesn't also lobby and do campaign donations and so on, because they do. And they want to control all those parts of the process as well. But those parts of the political process are way more open and porous and susceptible to negotiation between these different, fractions of classes, which in the case of the deeper parts of the state apparatus are not as open. Those are venues you participate in by invitation only.
So you have been describing how since the Great Recession, we've seen the unprecedented rise of giant asset management companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street that have displaced the banks as the most powerful institutions in finance. Where do they fall politically in the tale you're describing here of the different fractions of the capitalist class and smaller capital within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party?
There's been a lot of debate about the extent to which these asset management companies, represent a meaningfully different political set of political interests than the traditional financial sector does. And whether or not, for example, they're more tolerant of inflation, because whereas, traditional banks hate inflation, maybe the asset management companies, since they make most of their money from owning and exchanging equities, maybe they don't mind inflation as much. In truth, it seems like those differences are kind of overstated. But more broadly speaking, the asset management companies, especially BlackRock, which is the most powerful, have been very closely connected to the Democratic Party. Brian Deese, who was a former BlackRock executive, was Biden's chief economic advisor. And BlackRock executives played a large role in the Hillary Clinton campaign. And they also played a significant role in relation to Kamala Harris, along with a host of other billionaires. Kamala Harris in general has been very, very close to the financial sector. And in fact, you know, her whole economic program was developed in close consultation with the leading sections of finance, including the asset management companies, but also much more broadly. I think the financial sector in general, along with much of big capital, was very strongly supportive of Harris.
So then why do you think that these elites, these members of big capital, particularly fear Trump and have backed Harris? You know, Trump obviously offers to give them even lower corporate taxes, make an environment that in many ways sounds even more capital friendly than the Democrats. So what is the anxiety around Trump and how deep is it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think Trump is very attuned to the project of trying to extend the support or expand his support from among big capital. And I think, you know, by and large, when he becomes the president, I think sections of big capital will be more than happy to receive the tax breaks and so on that he's going to give them. I think there's a general skepticism of the chaos that Trump brings, and the extent of the revision of existing political institutions and forms of governance that he seems to favor. Right? As of now, liberal democratic institutions are working very well for big capital. They're supporting the power of big capital quite effectively. I mean, despite the dysfunction that I mentioned, I mean, the delegitimation among the part of the population of the political system. From the point of view of big capital, they kind of have it on lockdown. And insofar as elections legitimate the system at all, they're working to support the interests of big capital, you know, now that Bernie Sanders has been dealt with. They've been serving to support the interests of big capital and globalization very effectively. And Trump is now emerging, and he's emerging as a representative of this mobilized petty bourgeois and small business insurgency, which is building within the structure of a political party that maintains a direct tie to big capital. Right, the Republican Party is by no means like a petty bourgeois party; it's still a party of big capital overwhelmingly. But it's one that the petty bourgeois insurgency that was catalyzed coming out of 2008 has been able to build a certain base of power in and express a relatively problematic, from the point of view of big capital, set of political interests, which contradict the project of globalization and the making of global capitalism that big capital has been benefiting from and supporting since World War II. And so Trump's insistence on, you know, raising tariffs, not just on strategic military technologies and so on, as Biden has supported, but much more broadly, right, dramatically shifting the tax structure potentially so that much of federal government revenues are derived from tariffs, which would potentially be quite disruptive to the current, you know, globalized structure of the American economy and American capital. Apart from that, there's just the general kind of political chaos and unpredictability that Trump brings. And this is characteristic of hard right politics in advanced capitalist countries in general. You know, there's a way in which the petty bourgeoisie is the traditional base of hard right politics, as you mentioned earlier. And that means that this is a distinct set of interests than big capital. So insofar as hard right parties are able to get into the state on the basis of having gain support from the petty bourgeoisie, there's a contradictory back and forth between, you know, needing to sustain that tie to the petty bourgeois base of these hard right politics on the one hand, but also needing to govern in ways that don't fundamentally undermine the interests of big capital on the other, and even indeed represent and embody the interests of big capital on the other hand. So this creates a very contradictory back and forth kind of you know, chaotic political alliance between the petty bourgeois and big capital, which is actually quite explosive and has been explosive historically. And as we see the levels of political dysfunction that emerged around the Trump presidency in 2016 and the way that Trump acted, you know, not necessarily to resolve the political crisis that led to his ascent to executive power, but actually to make it worse. By casting doubt on the legitimacy of American elections, for example, one of the core pillars through which the whole economic and political order is legitimated. You know, Trump is out there saying that these elections are fundamentally unfair and illegitimate. So this election denialism has extended and deepened the generalized political crisis that has created the social conditions whereby hard right politics has been able to build. And I think capital would, as a whole, big capital would rather him not do that. They would rather have the elections be seen as legitimate and fair, and the system as it exists be seen as just and you know, the best of all possible worlds. And, you know, the rotation in power between, you know, one part of the capitalist class and another, you know, the Republican and Democratic parties kind of proceed as quote unquote normal. But instead, what you see is Trump kind of deepening the ideological crisis. But at the same time, as he does that, he also offers, you know, on the basis of having built this base in the petty bourgeoisie, but at the same time as he deepens the ideological crisis, he also offers a potential path to resolve that crisis, which is not through the normal mechanisms of liberal democratic rule, but through some kind of hard right authoritarian form of governance that would be a potential alternative. And I think that's where the real danger lies in terms of where this all goes.
We'll ask you more about that in a moment. But I wanted to ask you about the fanning of these contradictions between big capital, smaller capital, the petty bourgeoisie, small business, and how that might shake out. One of the places where one sees that is around agriculture and immigrant labor and Trump's statements that he's going to expel a record amount of people, 15 million undocumented workers. Now, of course, deporting undocumented workers is not something that would be unique to the Republican Party. As we know, Obama and Biden both deported record numbers up until this point. And yet, the kind of scale of what Trump promises to do would be very hard to imagine, both logistically, cost-wise, and also because it would be so incredibly disruptive to big agriculture that relies on undocumented labor. And yet, at the same time, it sort of raises the question of how much of these sorts of political agendas and statements on the part of Trump have to do with what his ultimate goals are, and how much has to do with both pleasing his base, because, of course, much of small business, small capital relies on cheap immigrant labor, and also the threat of deporting people can be as effective as deporting them in the sense that it keeps labor cheap, it demobilizes people who might try to organize themselves, and makes it very tough for people to push back against their employers. So I guess what I'm asking here is, aren't there multiple levels to what looks rhetorically like it is designed to satisfy some, and yet some of the way that it may play itself out may end up serving other goals and keep satisfied a different sector of his potential support?
Yeah, this is a really kind of critical question that gets right at the heart, I think, of all these issues. I mean, of course, if Trump were to deport 15 million people, first of all, that would be incredibly disruptive to the small business and petty bourgeois base that he's relied upon. But this also points to and it would secondarily, of course, be extremely inflationary, which would not be good for Trump in broader political terms. But this gets also to the kind of contradictions in the alliance, the class alliance that Trump represents. And because on the one hand, you have small business and the petty bourgeoisie that benefits from cheap immigrant labor. On the other hand, you have a expanding lumpen proletariat and downwardly mobile sections of the working class, which resent cheap immigrant labor and believe that if these immigrants were removed, that their wages would go up. And this contradiction has been bridged up until now by the fact that small business can benefit from the attacks on immigrant labor that Obama and Trump and Biden all carried out. Because, of course, you know, attacking the rights of immigrant workers basically means, as you say, that maintaining a precarious status that holds wages low. Meanwhile, in terms of Trump's hard right politics, the lumpen proletariat elements and downwardly mobile working class elements of his alliance can feel that their interests are being represented because Trump's beating up on immigrants that you know are holding their wages down. So this contradiction has been bridged, where both small business petty bourgeois types and the working class and lumpen parts of the base can both feel that their interests are being represented through these attacks on workers. But I think the critical thing about this, well, first of all, in terms of the numbers, you know, whether Trump's going to deport 15 million people, I don't think that's possible. I don't think the state has the possibility to, has the capacity to do that. I've seen interviews with people who have been in and around the ICE agency who have said that there's just no capacity to do this. I've seen commentary by immigration attorneys who say that there's no way that this can realistically be done just based on the legal processes that are in place and how long this would take and the administrative hurdles that would have to be crossed to do anything like this. There's also the question I've heard talk about how Trump might target this policy first at Chinese people and use it as a way of ramping up the kind of anti-China dimension of his political kind of worldview, his political kind of discourse. But I think all this stuff aside, I mean, there's very real contradictions in his base and there's very real difficulties with fulfilling such an ambitious, so to speak, program. But I think the real, this has to be seen in terms of Trump's orientation toward transforming the state. It's not, yes, he wants to beat up on immigrants. He wants to deport a lot of people and he's going to have to do that. But what he really wants to do is transform the state, transform the way that the political process functions in the United States. So yes, Obama and Biden deported very large numbers of people, but they didn't build like extensive migrant camps that are going to be, you know, which is what they're talking about doing now, whereby, you know, potentially millions of people are living behind barbed wire, fenced off from the rest of society, awaiting deportation trials or something, potentially for years. And once you start building these capacities of the state, to, you know, go door to door asking for people's papers, stopping cars, trying to see if people are legal. I just saw a story saying that the Haitian immigrants in Springfield have started leaving in droves for fear of mass deportation. And these are people who are living here legally. And some sheriff just a couple of miles outside of Springfield apparently instructed local police, you know, arrest these people and bring them here and I'll decide if they're legal. So this is the kind of revision to the political, to the normal forms of political rule that Trump is really, I think, thinking in terms of, which is to say, it's once you start building these capacities and once you start changing the orientation of policy toward undertaking these kinds of projects, the political culture shifts, and you start to see a transformation in the state itself and how it functions, where the centers of power are, and how it's organized in ways that are extremely, extremely dangerous. And I think that's really what this is about.
Stephen Marr is my guest. He is the author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance, co-editor of The Socialist Register. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you were talking about Trump remaking the state, and I wanted to ask you about the financing of the state. Trump's key victory in his first term was his massive tax cuts, and he's now floating eliminating the income tax, and of course has plans for more cuts to corporate taxes, his talk of using tariffs to fill the breach is, I think, pretty unconvincing to most people that that would be in any way sufficient. And I wanted to ask you what you think of those sort of proposals, how you understand it within what you're talking about this desire to remake the state, whether that kind of thing is real, and also to place it within a larger trajectory of, in the United States, of taxation being reduced by the state, that state programs have been financed by debt, and how you see that in this larger sweep.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about this. I mean, so the transition from what the political economist Wolfgang Streck called the tax state to the debt state was part of resolving the crisis of the 1970s. But it also led to the empowerment of finance over the state in a significant way, because it meant that now all state programs, you know, there's a kind of virtual parliament of financiers who have a kind of veto power of kind over state policy, right? In the event that investors, financiers, don't want to lend the government money to carry out its programs, then it's the government's going to face higher interest rates, and there's that new constraint that's you know, the extension of that constraint on state policy, and it also has meant that, you know, rather than, you know, financing state budgets, state expenditure through taxation, the state financing its expenditure through debt means that these wealthy individuals and financiers who purchase government bonds, you know, instead of paying taxes, they're lending the state money, which is then repaid to them with interest, right? So the state kind of becomes a vehicle for upward redistribution of income in that way, when you have a state financing through debt rather than taxation. Now, since 2016, the hole in the state deficit, you know, has been massive, right? We have a huge, huge and growing deficit. And there seems to be this orientation now that deficits simply don't matter. Theoretically, that could be the case, although it's never been tested how much they matter. The American state certainly has unique capacities to run massive deficits, partly because every country in the world has to hold dollars as foreign exchange in order to participate in world trade. So that allows the American state to run huge deficits, which can be financed as these other states, which have to hold dollars in, as foreign exchange, basically lend them to the American government by purchasing treasury bonds. But with deficits that are this large, one has to start asking, what are the limits of this? And there has been some sign of shakiness in treasury markets. Now, theoretically, the Federal Reserve could absorb 100% of the treasury market. It could just purchase all the outstanding treasuries and therefore, you know, undertake what economists call monetizing the debt, basically printing money to finance state expenditure. That's never been tried. So it might work. Theoretically, it would work in the case of the United States. And there's a very influential strand of post-Keynesian economics, which argues that this is indeed very possible. But it's certainly something that hasn't been done before. And it could potentially open the door for some serious instability. Typically speaking, treasury bonds, you know, American debt, has been seen as basically bulletproof in the global economy because the American treasury is the foundation of the whole global system. So if treasury bonds are having problems, then the whole system is having problems. So there's nothing safer in the world economic system than treasury bonds. So paradoxically, a couple of years ago, when, you know, some of the credit rating agencies, when the Tea Party was, you know, pushing this limiting the debt ceiling, increasing the debt ceiling, you know, some of the credit rating agencies downgraded U.S. debt, which basically means they're saying there's a greater risk that the Americans could default on their debt. And what happened? Treasury rates, people flooded into treasuries. Investors purchased treasuries. Why? Because any sign of risk in the global system means that people are going to flock into the safest assets. And traditionally speaking, treasuries are the safest assets, right? They are as safe as the system itself. And so if there's a problem in treasury markets, you end up with a problem, a very serious problem of global capitalism as a whole. And so, you know, blowing a deeper hole in the budget that of the kind that Trump is suggesting doing could potentially lead to a significant crisis. It's not clear what the consequences of that will be.
On the one hand, you've been arguing that there are parts of capital that don't trust Trump, don't trust his agenda, and also the competing interests that he's balancing. At the same time, you also said that there are sectors of capital that actually might decide that an authoritarian solution is a better one. What I'm asking is, what would compel those sectors of capital to feel like authoritarianism is necessary, especially since the kinds of threats that, say, big business are facing tend not to be the ones you were describing before, of a kind of left-wing insurgency or those who would come after their profits. If anything, the threat to them seems to be from the far right and the petty bourgeoisie.
Right. I mean, so what the question you're basically asking is, why would a capitalist class, whether the American capitalist class in this case, but really any capitalist class, why fascism? Why some alternative to liberal democracy? And I think here, you know, the insights of the Marxist state theorist Nikos Palantzis are really important, which is that fascism does not and has not historically come out of a situation in which there is what he refers to as a catastrophic equilibrium between capital and labor, right? A situation in which the working class is so strong that they're threatening the capitalist system as a whole. Rather, fascism has come out of situations in which the working class is already defeated, and in which historical situations in which in that context, a political crisis arises whereby the status quo is unsustainable and unacceptable from the point of view of broad swath of the population, and in which the left is unable to offer an alternative path out based on egalitarian, you know, universalist political principles. And in those cases, those are the cases in which, you know, fascism has tended to emerge. And so I think the question really comes down to one of, you know, in the event that things get so bad that the existing political institutions have totally failed to successfully govern, to adequately and functionally govern the capitalist system in the United States today, which I don't think we're there yet, but one can imagine. There's an authoritarian, nationalist, xenophobic, hard right alternative that can serve as the basis both for legitimacy and to support accumulation. And that would require severing the, you know, the hard right forces from their base in the petty bourgeoisie and other fractions of, you know, other classes and class fractions, the lumpen proletariat, sections of the working class. It would have to involve severing those hard right political figures, Trump and others, from that petty bourgeois base and you know, making it, you know, transforming them into a vehicle for carrying out the interests of big capital. And that is what ended up happening in Germany and Italy, right? Those fascist parties were primarily initially backed by the petty bourgeoisie. Once they got into power, they made a deal with big capital, and gradually their representative ties to the petty bourgeois, you know, sections that had supported them all along were broken, and they carried out the policies of the most advanced and dynamic sectors of big capital. But they did so in a very contradictory way. And in order to maintain their own legitimacy, they had to kind of be constantly in this herky-jerky fashion, going back and forth and back and forth between, you know, doing something that would appear to be quote-unquote anti-capitalist or challenging the interests of big capital and on behalf of a petty bourgeois base that they needed to maintain. And on the other hand, carrying out the overall agenda and the overall interests of big capital, which is ultimately what ended up happening. So fascism and hard right politics can't be understood as like a card that capital just plays when things get tough for it, and they just pull out of their back pocket whenever they want. It emerges out of an uncontrollable situation of crisis as the least bad of the available options for sustaining the accumulation and the overall social power of the capitalist class. So the question you're really asking is how far away are we from a situation in which that becomes the case? And of course, I can't answer that. But I think Trump has a, and the people around Trump have a very clear desire to create such a situation and to push this petty bourgeois anti-capitalism. And by petty bourgeois anti-capitalism, I mean, you know, an anti-capitalism that is not communist or not socialist, but which is a kind of restoring the capitalist golden age anti-capitalism by disrupting the power of the big monopolies and so on. He wants to push that as far as he can, and in so doing, to discredit and delegitimate the liberal institutions of capitalist democracy that currently carry out the legitimation functions that support capitalist rule, and therefore to create an alternative, at least put forward a possible alternative, in the form of hard right nationalism, racism, xenophobia, authoritarianism, and all the rest of it. So you know, the danger is that capital comes to see that as a better alternative or a safer alternative for sustaining its social power in the context of a generalized political crisis. And I think it needs to be noted in this context that, as I was saying earlier, you know, the state is relatively autonomous from the economy and from the dominant sections of capital. That also means that economic crisis and political crisis don't necessarily coincide. So the 2008 crisis, you know, played a major role in generating the economic crisis, in generating the current political crisis, as we were saying earlier. But that crisis has been resolved, right? There's no current crisis, economic crisis of capital. Profits are high. Capitalists are doing very, very well. Productivity is up. The American economy is overwhelmingly dominant. But that does not mean that there's no political crisis. And in fact, the way in which the 2008 crisis was resolved in economic terms is precisely what led to the current political crisis. And so, you know, I think capital would prefer the status quo. But the question is, how sustainable is that status quo going to be? Not just in terms of the economy, but also in terms of the political situation. And of course, we're also now in a situation where we are very likely to sail past 2 degrees Celsius of warming. And when we do, as we do, that is certain to throw up unprecedented challenges for governing society, for governing the economy, and for sustaining social order, and so on, and political legitimacy. And so I think part of what, you know, Trump is also representing is a part of the political and economic elite, but as well as the petty bourgeoisie, that decide that have decided that we're not going to do anything about climate change. We're going to just drive into the abyss as fast as we can. And you know, in the context of the kinds of stresses that are going to emerge from that process, inevitably, I think the idea that we're just going to have normal, stable, liberal democracy and rotation in power between two bourgeois parties, I think that it's very likely that some part of the elite, economic and political, will come to the realization that that's not something that is compatible with that kind of situation, and that an alternative means, political means, of protecting their social power may become necessary.
Well, on that bleak note, Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here, despite the inauspicious circumstances.
Stephen Marr is Assistant Professor of Economics at SUNY Cortland, co-author with Scott Aquano of The Fall and Rise of American Finance. Steve Marr is co-editor of The Socialist Register. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.